Group meeting, Saturday, 23rd June, 1984. The world of religion is in need of renovation. A good many of the old teachings and doctrines of all the religions of the world no longer hold good. Not that they did hold good in the past in so many respects, but they certainly don't hold good anymore. We have talked during the autumn and throughout these winter months about the ordinary teachings which have been part and parcel of the fundamental beliefs in the religions. The belief that each person has an individual soul, that soul will reap the consequences of the body's actions during its lifetime. Now, they have talked of the soul as being immortal, and they have also talked of the soul as belonging to each person as a separate entity. Now, this is utter nonsense. It is an impossibility for an entity, a separate entity, to be immortal. The very word entity means that something specific has come into being, is born. And if anything has come into being, it inevitably proceeds with its life, and when its span is over, it dies. It disintegrates altogether. So to talk of an immortal soul is a tremendous absurdity. Similarly, to talk of God as the creator of the universe, declare that God is infinite, eternal and immortal, and then proceed to say that God is a particular being, and particularly in Catholic teaching, wholly other than creation. The creator is wholly other than the created, is again completely nonsensical. Any God that is born, I beg your pardon. They do start off by saying that he is self-existent. He is always there. But to say that he is an entity, a separate entity, simply means that in actual fact, if he were an entity, he was derived from some sort of source. You see? So the concept of an immortal, eternal, infinite God who is the creator of the universe is an entity is just totally absurd. So we must be free of all such concepts. Then again, the idea that after the death of the body, the psychophysical organism, the soul will reap the consequences in an eternal heaven or in an eternal hell. This is all completely false. How on earth can a finite mortal individual so live that the consequences of his life in terms of thought and feeling, speech and action can be infinite? Whatever I think, feel, speak and do is finite. It is a small thing. It will have its own effects during my lifetime upon myself and upon my environment, undoubtedly. And that will, and in that process, all the consequences will naturally work out. To say that after I am dead, my soul, which I positively say is non-existent as a separate entity, is supposed to reap consequences forever and ever, which again is completely absurd. Now this idea of heaven and hell, unfortunately, has seeped even into Hindu and Buddhist teachings, in the Upanishads and all Hindu teachings, and in the Buddha's teachings too. He himself says you go into a heaven world and this and that, or you go, you uprise in hell, which is utter nonsense. Now I'll present a totally different view, which I think is probably, certainly if it is not probably, at least it is possibly nearer reality than all this old nonsense. What we call the body is the totality. It is a holographic representation of the totality. Now that, if we can really grasp that idea, or that way of, if we can really understand that way of looking at things, we will see that we are, microcosmically, the totality, which also the macrocosm is, a totality. You see? That means that all that we say about a person, body, soul, spirit, psyche, use whatever terms you like, everything is there simultaneously. Now it is true that the context in which the body lives and functions is the context of the finite, the temporal, and therefore the mortal. That is the context of the body itself as an organism. But since the person as such is a totality, the context of what we call spirit, consciousness, or soul, or whatever it is a different context. It is a context of infinity, of eternity, and of immortality. Then people will say, well, what happens to me when I die? What dies? The body dies, of course, as body. But as matter, it is not dead. All the chemical elements which compose the body, the carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, calcium, phosphorus, sulfur, anything and everything just goes back into the universal stock of the chemical elements. So, as matter, which was the body named Firoz, will just once again return immortally into matter as such. Then take the other aspects, the psyche, the mind, the spirit, soul, call it what you like, you see. All that just is itself. The totality of eternity and infinity is all embodied in every particular manifestation. Whether it be an atom, a microbe, a virus, whether it be us, or a tree, or a solar system, or a galaxy. Now, these are, people will quite legitimately, of course, because they have been conditioned to look at things in a certain way, they will say, this man is just presenting his own particular flights of imagination. All right? Call them flights of imagination. But if they are examined carefully, you will probably find that there is more to this flight of imagination than the flights of imagination of the last 6,000 years. Of all the world, the founders of the religion, Zarathustra was practically the first one. It was he who started the idea of a personal divine being, a personal God. Remember, he was a member of the Indo-European peoples. In those days, his ancestors moved about in the steppe lands of Central Asia. They had a developed theological system which consisted of many gods. They believed in invisible powers, conscious powers, who controlled all the phenomena of nature. Now, as man advances, what happens is that his consciousness evolves out of the state of manyness into a state of unitary wholeness. That is the direction in which human consciousness is evolving. In fact, I would say all consciousness, wherever it is. You can start from the plant and the animal and into man. What we are evolving to is the consciousness in terms of unitary wholeness. That's one of the purposes of our existence. Now, Zarathustra sensed that. And sensing that, what he did was to do away with many gods and produce the idea that there is only one supreme being. He was the man also who produced the idea of each individual having his own immortal soul. And he was the man who said, and this is the origin of the Hindu-Buddhist law of karma and so forth. He said that whatsoever you do, think, feel, and so forth, will produce a consequence to you. You live evilly, your soul will have evil consequences. And for all time, he said that, definitely, for all time. He never realized. In his day it was not possible to realize. Remember, he flourished about 3,500 years ago. I mean, the idea of infinity and eternity was simply non-existent then. To them, all time was eternity, which it is not, of course. Time and eternity are quite different. Eternity subsumes time. It negates time without destroying time. Time is the illusory manifestation of eternity. Now, he didn't know that, I'm sure. My dear countrymen, I mean the Parsis and Zarathustrians of the world, they'll throw bricks at my head for saying things like this. He didn't understand that, and he said that your soul will for all time suffer the consequences of your deeds. He also said something which is the very reverse of what the Buddha taught 1,000 years later after him. The Buddha emphasized the mind as the most important thing, the origin of speech and action and so forth. And Zarathustra taught that the deed is the more important thing. The mind is less important and so forth. So now, he started that, but he started the idea of an absolute justice, the justice of God. But this justice included the manifestation of cruelty and hate. I mean, fancy God, this supreme being, creating all these souls, creating the body. In the Gathas you will find that Zarathustra says, "Thou, O Lord, have created all these bodies," and so forth. He says that, you see, creating all this, and then he goes and has this tit-for-tat system of divine justice. Perfectly ridiculous. I've said this before. Aristotle probably gave one of the best presentations of justice. Justice is the practice of perfect virtue towards all people and towards yourself. Justice is the practice of perfect virtue towards all people and towards yourself. But Aristotle flourished 1,200-1,300 years after Zarathustra. Don't forget that. So there was time for development. Now, all these ideas, and Zarathustra also taught that at the end, this is something very interesting. He was really marvelous here. That he taught that time comes to an end. At the end of time, when the good and evil has been worked out by the soul, there will be a resurrection. He only said there will be a resurrection. He didn't say how and in what form and so forth. As the centuries passed by, Zarathustrian brains, clever people, produced all sorts of conceptions of this resurrection. And they said that the soul will pick up all the bones which will become enfleshed during the lifetime, you see. And they will come to life again on earth and out of the earth. Then, after the resurrection, all people who are all, every soul therefore that has lived up till the resurrection, and the bodies and their bodies will undergo another ordeal. This ordeal was an extraordinarily horrible conception, really. And it was stated by people after the Christian era started, that two of the angels, the angel of fire, of course he was necessary for the technical part, and the angel of friendship or something like that. I forget the exact, but a nice sort of person. They would melt all the metals in the earth, and this molten metal will flow as a glowing river through which all beings, good and bad alike, who had been good and bad, will have to pass. The evil ones, who have not successfully expiated their crimes in hell, will of course be completely destroyed by this. And the good ones will feel this river of molten metal like warm milk. Now I ask you, in those days, of course, human beings being very gullible, they swallowed all this, lock, stock and barrel. And these ideas spread. In Judaism, in Christianity, in Islam, you have these ideas of resurrection and heaven and hell and this and that and the other. You see? So now, is it at all possible to allow such ideas to affect our lives anymore? We must look very carefully into ourselves. How easy it is for our upbringing and all the conditioning due to our upbringing to work upon us when we have grown up, when we are adults. There is an innate fear. There is an innate cruelty and horror. Our ideas of justice are this tit-for-tat justice. Justice heals. Divine justice and human justice ought to heal. Not to reward, not to punish. That is no use at all. Absolutely no use. But to heal. To purify and heal. Now, where purification is concerned, Zarathustra was marvelous. Zarathustrianism is perhaps the most powerful, has made probably the most powerful statement as regards the necessity for purification. But it didn't show the special way for that purification. The way which was accepted in those days was the way of ritual. If you performed this, that and the other ritual, you got purified, you purified the psychic atmosphere around you and so forth. Remember that those were the days of magic and the belief in magic. You see? Now, we can just put magic into the waste paper basket, that sort of magic. It just has no effect at all. It is perfectly true that what we think and feel does have an effect upon the whole psychical atmosphere and upon other people and so forth. If somebody is in a an extremely depressed state, he sort of spreads depression to other people near him. Isn't that so? And if somebody is very jolly, he spreads jollity around him. This is a common human experience. So that part is true enough. But the idea that a ritual will purify something by sheer magic is utter nonsense. Again, another good idea of Zarathustra was that all the elements which composed the earth, and of course the elements in those days didn't mean carbon, hydrogen, and so forth. It meant fire, earth, air, water. Those were the elements. And you see, the cult elements from way back from the 5th millennium before Christ were water and fire. They were the great cult elements. And it was on those two cult elements that all the religious systems, religious in the sense of the ritualistic part of religion, the ritualistic systems were all built up. That is why in Zarathustrianism it was forbidden in the old days to cremate, because that pollutes the fire. It was forbidden to bury, because that pollutes the earth, and so forth. Now, all these ideas must go. But it is strange that if we really critically examine people's mental functioning, we will find that these ideas still have some sort of influence. I did so and so when I was 13 years old, and now I'm paying the penalty for it now. Not at all. That's utterly absurd. The penalty comes, or the reward comes, immediately, straight away. Whatsoever one does in the finite temporal sphere affects the infinite eternal sphere. And there is a response out of the infinite eternal upon the finite temporal. Now, what does that imply? The complete transmutation of the finite temporal into the infinite eternal through a process of transmutation, yes, which is a purification, it is a changing into something absolutely other. Something, as Shakespeare said, rich and strange, full fathom five, it's a marvelous set of lines, thy father lies, of his bones are coral made, those are pearls that were his eyes. Of him nothing doth remain, but suffers a sea change into something rich and strange. Note what Shakespeare said, into something rich and strange. The finite and temporal is enriched into the infinite eternal. So now, all our ordinary living process here and now, which is very considerably influenced by all sorts of absurd ideas and teachings. We call it karma and rebirth and all that sort of stuff nowadays, you see. It just doesn't hold good anymore. Absolutely doesn't hold good. If you look critically into the idea of rebirth, the Dalai Lama, in his book, The Opening of the Wisdom Eye, has a very interesting note about it at the end of the book. He has a whole series of notes in which he says that reincarnation is certainly not there, because the idea of reincarnation implies an entity which is permanent, which comes into birth again. He says that's not true. He doesn't very much approve of the word rebirth. But then what on earth are they talking about? I think if we accept what became later on the secondary meaning of the word jati, that will be a far more sensible way of looking at it. Its secondary meaning is a conditioned state. A birth, a beginning, is a conditioned state. Something specific has come into being. Its specificness is due to the fact that this, that and the other thing were conditioned in order to produce this thing. Get it? So that way you get a much less misleading idea of karma and the procedure of the karmic process. Now, today in the world, we are all like a band of lunatic criminals driving ourselves towards catastrophe. Look at the tremendous problems. The problem of population, nuclear energy, and the fear and the terror associated with it, and all the evil procedures of diplomats and politicians and so forth in connection with it. There is the problem of pollution. And the problem of pollution is far more serious than people are aware of. They are not aware what a terrible problem it is. Because if this sort of pollution goes on for some more decades or centuries, it will affect all life. It will certainly probably destroy all plant life in time, and with it life in the oceans. And there's this tremendous problem of acid rain produced by the solution of the oxides of nitrogen and sulfur, particularly, which are all belched out with the smoke from factories and so on into the atmosphere, and which produce acids, which are destructive to life. There are these tremendous problems, and people all over the world are wasting their intelligence and energies in trying to solve that problem in material ways. I'm not suggesting for a moment that they should cease to try material ways. Of course, material ways will have to be used also. But they never consider for a single moment what is the root source from which nuclear energy, pollution, increased population arise. The root source of the world's evil is myself. Never mind the others. The others are different versions of myself. That is all. I am greedy. I want more and more and more and more. I am under the curse, accursed belief that possessions will mean fruition, happiness, success, doing good, and all the rest of it. Which is absolute nonsense. All that we need, our essential needs, of course, must be satisfied. Food, warmth, shelter. We can add to that, in modern times particularly, education and health. But health not with the objective of enjoying life, as the world calls it more, which means chasing and indulging in sensational delights. I don't mean health in that sense, but in the real sense. Education, unfortunately, ever since this idea of universal education started when 1884, Mandela's Act, anybody know the exact date? Act of Parliament was passed for universal education. And what did it mean? Teaching so many thousands and thousands of children certain things which would make them efficient tools for production, for accumulating wealth. What have we accumulated? Wealth? In the real sense of the word? And what is the price we are paying for this accumulated stuff? So you see, education has gone wrong that way. It has produced millions of slaves. That's what it has produced. The working population of the country in all the industries and this and that. What are we? Wheels and cogs in a tremendous machine. And you all know the consequences of it all, the boredom, the tiredness, and therefore the organization of holidays and whatnot has to come into being. All in the belief, this is being happy, being well, and so forth. And the body is attended to from the medical point of view in order to prolong its life. Yes, of course, it's a good thing to live a long life. But live a long life through having lived sensibly, intelligently, right from childhood onwards. Otherwise, don't live a long life. Look at geriatrics and the misery they have to suffer. So you see, we have to wake up to the fact that all these troubles come from just myself, from within myself. My greed, my fear and anxiety, my violence, my hate, my absurd ideas of what is right and wrong and so forth. Some of my ideas are not too bad, but still. and my illusions and my delusions. All these are the real root source from which proceed all my desires, my thinking, my feeling, my planning, my acting. Now, if people wake up to this, they will get the devil by the throat. I don't suggest for a moment that they should squeeze that throat. The devil's myself, he's a very good chap. He has the possibility of being no other than God. And my task, if I am to cooperate with the evolutionary process of the entire cosmos, is to convert this devil into God. That is my task. That is another purpose of my existence as an ordinary human being. And that takes place as I develop in my inner consciousness towards the consciousness in terms of unitary wholeness. In that consciousness, there is no otherness. If there is no otherness, I have nobody to fight with. You are me and I am you. Whatsoever I do for benefit for you benefits me, and also whatsoever I do for the benefit of me benefits you. So there is a universal benefit thereby. But this is the sort of thing which is rather difficult to see in the real sense. By seeing, I do not mean having an idea, having a conception merely. That is just the outer covering. That's not the real living energy. To see in the supreme sense means to be completely conscious of. We can all talk very piously, oh, we must help our suffering brethren and so forth. We must help, we must be good to so and so, we must be truthful and all the rest of it. But I say that as the result of a little churning up in my brain with words in the language. And all that is completely impotent. The proof of what I say is just this: look at the state of the world. Let us look at our own lives, our own selves. So now you see, all this has to undergo a radical transformation, absolutely a radical transformation. And no one can compel me or compel you to bring about that radical transformation. Only each person individually, by himself, can wake up to it, can, if he has the least sensitivity in him, see that this is the way in which I have to move. When a person is really conscious of something, that consciousness expresses itself naturally, spontaneously, invariably, and inevitably in terms of the good. Because what the innermost consciousness is, and this is the hidden part of us, this is what some people have sometimes called the spark of divinity embodied in us. What one is really, one's innermost consciousness is the unknown, invisible source from which proceed all our thinking, feeling, doing, and speaking. All these are the expression of that innermost consciousness. And when that innermost consciousness undergoes the change, because the innermost consciousness expresses itself as all this, but all this also affects the innermost consciousness. This is where one's personal choice comes into play. We have that much freedom, we have that much free will as a possibility. We have to be fortunate enough to have the circumstance which helps us to sort of see something different, something new, something different, not in the direction of regression, but in the direction of progression. You see? So now, if we look at things that way, then we'll see that our fundamental task is a religious one. Because what is this transformation of consciousness which we are talking of? It is a case of a repentance, which means a turning away from, that's what repentance means, a turning away from that which is all muddled and ill and terrible, towards that which is healthy, well, holy. So in that sense, it's the quality of religiousness which has to be present there. And this has nothing to do with subscribing to this, that or the other doctrine or belief. We can throw all our beliefs and our conceptions, which are mostly misconceptions, into the waste paper basket. They are no use at all. They are impotent. But this turning around in the innermost seat of consciousness, as it is put in Mahayana Buddhism, for instance, this turning about has to take place, and it can take place only through one's own longing for the perfect. If that longing is there, if that sincerity is there, the turning about will begin. The way to fruition, to fulfillment, is within ourselves all the time. It's not outside ourselves. So, that way, this renovation of religion has to take place. A new ontology, a new cosmogony and a cosmology, not a cosmogony, we don't want a cosmogony. We naturally have to have a new cosmology. All the gods, well, they are laid to rest. And we can write in big characters, R.I.P. to all the gods. Every one of them, the true gods so-called and the not-so-true gods so-called. Because you are the divine embodied. And through the process of the embodiment, the divine did not know how to embody itself without producing sources of illness. That's what went wrong. So you can blame God for it. God laughs all the time. He also cries all the time. That means we can laugh and cry all the time, together. Both are necessary. The crying is necessary for the purification. And the laughing is necessary for the energy which will never stop going forward and coming to fruition. And that way, we shall avoid, the human race will avoid catastrophe, not otherwise.